Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about aviation security. Homeland Security officials continue to say that commercial aviation is a prime target for terrorists. Since the attacks of 9/11, passenger screening certainly has been stepped up. However, security experts say that we are perhaps concentrating too much on the methods that were used by the terrorists in the last attack, and that leaves the system vulnerable. This morning on Focus 580, in this hour, we will review some of the changes in air security that have been put into place since 9/11. And our guest for this hour of the program is Mary Schiavo. She has worked in government and also is an attorney. She is a member now of the American Bar Association and works for the firm of Motley Rice, LLC, which is a firm that specializes in dealing with aircraft people who have been harmed or killed in air crashes. She's a graduate of New York University, got her law degree there. She had several posts in government. She was Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Labor. She also served as the Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation. That's between 1990 and 1996. She then went into higher education and was Professor of Aviation at Ohio State University and also Professor of Public she was Professor of Public Policy at Ohio State. She was Professor of Aviation at Ohio State. She is, in addition to all of that, a licensed private pilot and author of a book that was published a number of years ago about the air industry, titled Flying Blind, Flying Safe. She is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use the toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or if you might be happening to be listening over the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that toll-free line as well, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. We have just a small technical glitch here. We will have to, I think, reconnect with our guest. We will do that in a moment and give you the opportunity to call in, again, ask questions and make comments. Just maybe I'll take the opportunity very quickly to mention again, in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about the economic policies of the Bush administration. And our guest there will be Daniel Altman. He is both an economist and a journalist, works for the New York Times, or contributing there as a columnist. Also with Business 2.0, he is the author of a new book, which is titled Neoeconomy, George Bush's Revolutionary Gamble with America's Future. And it takes a look at some of the basic economic ideas of the administration. Probably his number one priority when he was running for office was a tax cut. And they had in mind putting in that tax cut so that they could foster savings. We'll talk about more what that will mean for the American economy. That will be in hour number two. Now, we'll be talking with our guest for this part of Focus 580, Mary Schiavo. Ms. Schiavo, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As I mentioned, we just fairly recently, I think, there was a hearing in Congress. Security experts were there, and they were talking about this. And this is the first time this whole issue of airline security, I think, had been really discussed since the 9/11 Commission released its recommendations. And basically what these people were saying is that we responded to the last attack, and we have been looking particularly at things like trying to make sure that passengers can't carry things onto the plane that can be used as weapons. And I'm sure everybody would say that's good. However, what they're saying is that we're making that oft-made mistake that what we're doing is we're fighting the last war. We're not looking ahead to what the next one will be, and there are still gaps in the system, places that potential hijackers, terrorists could take advantage of. Do you think that's an accurate statement of where we are?
It's an accurate statement of where we are, and it's also an accurate statement of how we have done things literally over the last 40 years. And if you look at our safety and security regulations, what you find we do is we respond to the last attack or the last tragedy, if it's an accident as opposed to terrorist attack, and that's literally how we have made our laws and regulations. But unfortunately, we have tied ourselves up in this problem, in this conundrum, because our federal regulatory standards require a cost-benefit analysis. They require a certain cost in life or injuries or tragedy before the government acts. And a lot of that was a fallout in terms of government expenditures or what they call unfunded mandates. And so it was a vicious circle. The government was trying to say, well, we aren't going to make people spend money, but the way that that comes about, including local governments and state governments, but the problem with that is that also means that you have to have a loss before you act, which makes our government, you know, totally ineffective and also look extremely ridiculous and very vulnerable to terrorists. But that's what we did after Pan Am 103, which is the one that exploded over Lockerbie. We were focused on bombs in checked bags. Even though statistically we could see, and this has been well documented since 9/11, of course, that statistically it was shown that there were still hijackings, and when they occurred, they were very deadly. No longer was it take me to Cuba and let everybody off the plane, but it had focused on the Middle East, and it was hijackers trying to make a statement. So that's a big problem that we have. Now, of course, you don't want to leave the door open for a repeat attack or for copycat attacks.
Yeah,
but
well,
it's important to cover all bases.
Let's just look at that for a moment, the issue of people trying to carry, either intentionally or accidentally, carrying things on planes that either are weapons or can be used as weapons. Since 9/11, there's been a lot more passenger screening, and they're a lot more careful about what they let on the plane. Now, at the same time, though, when you look at the list of things that are allowed, here and there are things that you just shake your head at and think, well, isn't that a problem? For example, knitting needles, and maybe it's not. How well, just if we look at that particular issue, how well are we doing? Because it seems you get a lot of anecdotal evidence stories from people here and there around the country about how the regulations as they exist are not being uniformly enforced.
That's right. The things aren't being uniformly enforced, and of course, the screeners' performance levels, at least as checked by the General Accounting Office and the Office of Inspector General, are not vastly greater than the screeners' performance levels before, which tells us that we're doing the same old things in the same old ways. All we're looking for now is we're looking for box cutters and pepper spray, where before we let those things get onto the plane. So we're doing the same old thing. And when we look at other countries' models, for example, El Al, they have a rotation. People don't stare at the screen for hours on end. They do 20-minute stints, and then they rotate the jobs. And so they do the job differently. And that's important for us to do. Obviously, you have to screen to get items off of people, but we lost our focus because part of what was going on in 9/11 is we thought we had this sort of this magic profiling program on passenger screening, which would highlight those who were at risk. For example, half of the hijackers got profiled under the passenger screening program then in place. And, of course, it didn't work because they were looking for bombs and bags. And that was only one of the threats they were to look for. We've got some of the same mistakes going on now. We had CAPS 2, which is the computer-assisted passenger screening program. That just got dumped just at the time of the congressional hearings you mentioned. We dumped the new program, and then we're starting over again. So, you know, we do have to improve and do things differently, but unfortunately we've fallen back into some of the same old traps.
Well, let's talk about that, the passenger screening, for a moment, because we did, we have now had a couple of different systems for trying to identify by some kind of profile people who we might want to then give further scrutiny to.
Right.
And we did have this system. It was called Computer-Assisted Passenger Pre-Screening, CAPS.
Right.
And then there was going to be an upgrade of the system that they were going to call CAPS 2. And
right.
Now they've changed the name. I don't know if they've actually changed what they were going to do. Now we're calling this the secure flight system. But the idea basically is the same thing, is that you know that maybe you can't completely screen every single individual that might get on a plane in this country because there are so many. But you might say, okay, are there some characteristics of an individual that would give us some reason to be suspicious of them? And from that, then we might want to say, well, of all the people getting on the plane, here's 5 people or 10 people or whatever that we're really going to take a closer look at.
Mm-hmm.
And is that something that can work, and we just have not been very good at implementing it, or is there something about the basic concept that's not quite right?
No, it can work, and that's it, but we have to be prepared to do it in its fullest extent. For example, the CAPS notion, or the passenger screening, looking at the people and as opposed to the objects, that's the whole basis of the El Al security. And in fact, U.S. carriers operating in Europe, for example, use a form of the El Al security where they question individuals and they look at the individual traveler, but that's very time-consuming, which is why in this country we're looking to have this shortcut, and the shortcut is that you will agree to give the airlines and the TSA, for example, your credit records and things like that. Again, we're getting slightly misguided because the hijackers on 9/11 had credit records. They had frequent flyer accounts, et cetera. The problem that we run into is, which is a problem that simply doesn't exist for the El Al because they use some of these screening points. But the problem that we have is our constitutional sensitivity over things such as national origin and religion. And obviously the two things you would have wanted to be able to look at on 9/11 were sort of religious Muslim extremists who came from the Middle East. And those kinds of hot buttons, some people say, now I don't think so. I think you can make a difference based on the fact of whether someone's a citizen or not. But those particular points to do extra examinations of someone will, under some definitions, run afoul of the Constitution. And in light of 9/11, it seems fairly obvious that those things ought to be looked at, but there's a very strong legal reason also why people might argue you can't look at them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also perhaps people who are work in the field of terrorism would also suggest that if you develop that kind of a profile of the individual that you're concerned with, terrorist groups will be well aware of what the profile is, and that what they'll do is that they'll find someone who doesn't fit the profile. And so then you have to ask the question, well, how do you cast a wider net?
Well, that's right, and I think we've already seen that in Russia. They're using, it was always men, younger Middle Eastern men, and then they've been using women to carry it out. But, of course, even before 9/11, it was well documented that there had been women terrorists and women hijackers, but we saw the last two aviation attacks, at least allegedly at this point, they don't know for sure, but it appears it was carried out by women, which would certainly skew the profile, although curiously women often fit the profile, particularly women traveling alone, did fit some of the profiles even before 9/11, and particularly for drug carriers or drug mules.
Let me very quickly reintroduce our guest for anyone who has just tuned in. We're talking with Mary Schiavo. She's a former Inspector General in the U.S. Department of Transportation and also has taught public policy and was professor of aviation at Ohio State. And she has been interested in these issues for some time. She's an attorney with the firm of Motley Rice, LLC, and is also the author of a book published a number of years back titled Flying Blind, Flying Safe, based on some of the things that she saw during the time that she was with the Department of Transportation. And we're talking about airline security, aviation security. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's just pick up on one more issue, an issue that has, I think now, perhaps in a number of people's minds, that has to do with these two planes, these two Russian planes that went down in August. The thinking is, apparently, that these planes were brought down by suicide bombers who carried explosives with them, perhaps on their persons, onto the plane and detonated them. And as a result, the two planes went down. And this is, I think, one of these things right now that security experts point to as a very important gap in the system we have of screening passengers. We're screening them for things like knives and guns, but we don't have really had anything in place to screen people for explosives. Check bags are screened for explosives, but passengers aren't. And there are now some experiments getting people to go through detectors that would check to see if people were wearing explosives, but most passengers certainly are not. Do you consider this to be a serious problem?
Well, it is a serious problem, and it is also one that was thought about before 9/11. There were devices that were, at least in experimental phases, it was a almost like a sort of a sniffer device, almost like a phone booth where someone would go in and would be sensed for explosive, just as the bags are now in the CTX machines, where they would sense that. Right now, of course, if someone managed to put the explosives on someone in such a way that the person going through the security checkpoint did not touch them, because once they touched the bag, if the bag was screened for explosives, now we don't do 100% bag screen either of the carry-ons for explosives, but if they touched it, then you should be able to pick that up on the bag if it was on their hands. But if it was loaded in such a way that they did not contaminate anything that they touched, then theoretically that's right. The bags are supposed to be screened for explosives, even though we all know carry-ons aren't. But and then, of course, check bag is supposed to be 100% screened at this point. But that would be certainly be a loophole. Now, in the in Russia, and it's kind of hit or miss. I mean, some places have very Western-like conditions and security. You know, the Moscow airport is similar to Western airports, but there are a lot of problems and loopholes there. So assuming that they had to get it through on their person. Some of the screening equipment is antiquated there, and whether they had CTX machines to screen for explosives for all passengers going through, I mean, that's a great unknown. But certainly that would be one of the loopholes right now in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that, as I mentioned, there are now in a handful of airports, they're testing these sniffer machines that people walk through, kind of like we now have to walk through the metal detectors.
Right.
The problems with these machines are, one, they're very expensive, so it could cost, I think one figure I saw, something getting close to $300 million to put them everywhere. And then it also, there's an issue that it slows down the process of getting people checked in, mm-hmm. and getting them on the plane. So it's expensive. It's another delay. Do you anticipate at some time in the future, though, all airports will have these machines and either everybody or some percentage of passengers will have to go through them?
Well, at some point, you would hope that we have machines like that at the airport. What I probably fear is that the expense is so great, again, it will fall victim to the cost-benefit analysis. In other words, unless and until we actually suffer this kind of a tragedy, our federal regulations say that it may not be worth the cost, which is really absurd because we've already seen this happening. You know, our brain tells us this is a real risk and we do have to defend our country against it. But the way that the laws are made in Washington don't always make sense. So I think that we should have them and we should be building toward that system right now. Realistically, it often takes another tragedy before we actually make that large of an investment, and it will be a large investment.
Hmm. Let me ask you just one further question, and we have some callers here. It can be a very difficult and annoying thing to these days to travel by air, and now it takes longer than it did before. They want you there sooner. It may take longer to get through security and so forth. And it may indeed be that we're talking about things now that should be put into place that would make that process even more complicated and more difficult. And I guess I wonder, as people who think about airline security think about it, is there some kind of point that they start bumping up against that has to do with passenger resistance to things that are going to make it more complicated and more difficult take longer to get checked in and eventually to get on the plane so you can go where you're going to go?
No, I think what happens is the market starts to stratify itself, and we've already seen that. People who can afford to get out of the system, and obviously now in aviation we're talking about extremely wealthy individuals who can simply buy private jet transportation or can timeshare in a jet. And we have seen a boom in that industry. And in fact, that in some ways it has actually developed, it has encouraged the development of smaller, cheaper, lighter jet aircraft so more people can afford personal air transportation, is what we call it now. We don't even call it general aviation anymore. And so there's a big move afoot for personal jet transportation, which means that the market will get stratified. And then, of course, the people who have to take and pay the regular commercial airline system, which is, most of us, we'll really just have to put up with what it takes because of the, the very real problem, which was brought to light on 9/11, which is this, you're just not putting the airplane and the people on the plane at risk, which our regulations were content to do before 9/11. You're putting literally anything in this country or virtually the world at risk with each flight that you take off. So I think that realistically there aren't any limits. As long as the threat is there for new and more horrific kinds of terrorism, passengers will literally be subjected to whatever methodologies we have to try to address that, whether it works extremely well and efficiently or not. I think the passengers are going to be subjected to it.
Are more airlines offering something for the frequent flyers that will, for them, speed them through the system?
Well, they are and they're not, and it's very sporadic. For example, some airports have put in express first-class lines where if you have a first-class ticket and also, of course, for the crew, of course, but if you have a first-class ticket or a business-class ticket, you can speed through the checkpoint. I think the computerized check-in is very efficient and helps tremendously, but there are some places you just plain get bogged down. For example, the TSA security lines or the checking in the bags. I was in LA a few days ago, and the lines were just very, very long regardless of the airline's effort. So there are some things, it's not for frequent flyers, it's for the cost of the ticket largely, but some airports have tried to do that. There are a couple, where I've been recently, where they had big express lines. Portland had express lines for first class, Portland, Oregon. Several places have first class express lines, but it's still kind of hit or miss.
We're just about at our midpoint here, and I have a caller, and I apologize for making the person wait. One thing that we have to do, though, is this test, because it is the first Tuesday of the month. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Message was instituted by the Illinois Emergency Management Agency. This station is participating in a required monthly test of the Illinois Emergency Alert System. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
And you're listening to AM 580 WILL Urbana. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And again, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mary Schiavo, former Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation, someone who has been following airline issues, particularly airline safety and security issues, for quite a while. She has been Professor of Public Policy at Ohio State, as well as Professor of Aviation in the Department of Aerospace Engineering and Aviation in the College of Engineering, also at Ohio State, and she's now an attorney in private practice. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here we have a caller in Champaign County. Thank you for being patient. Go ahead.
Sure. I think there's more to talk about in the frequent flyer in this. I thought there was a program. I mean, we're insisting that Europeans have biometrics and that frequent flyers, and I think a lot of people are that use planes or people that use them a lot, and if they were expedited, then people that don't fly very often, like me, I haven't flown since 2 weeks after 9/11, right? But so I don't have any personal experience on how things are going in the lines, but I do listen to Harry Shear's satire, and he has a feature called Tales of Airport Security, and there are some absolutely surreal examples. I don't know if you use that for the fringe things, but the people report going through with all sorts of things. It's amazing. But what actually prompted me to call was when you said the problem is our Constitution. I realize I'm taking that out of context, but I think it's irreducibly part of it. And then he went on to say that we can't, you know, we should be able to profile, as it were, in certain ways. And my answer to all this is that we had a breakdown of the intelligence about these folks. They had been identified. You don't need to profile all Middle Easterns. You should follow people that you know had flight training and et cetera. And this idea that there was some kind of longstanding rule that that the Massawi laptop couldn't have been passed around and links couldn't have been found. I mean, the FBI had six people on a hooker case in New Orleans at the time, and they were pursuing anti-corporate globalization people around the country. And Newsnight and BBC have documented that the U.S. was pulling back on bothering the Saudis with questions before 911. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of stuff that could have been done, and what I see is this failure is now being allowed to be an excuse for very draconian things to happen in our country, and that actually resonates at a whole bunch of different levels. But I'll ask you to respond. And
well, you're absolutely right. You know, starting for example with the FBI and the Mousawi laptop. Where that broke down is exactly as the caller said. The agents in Minneapolis knew exactly that they had a problem, and they applied for something called the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act request, which is kind of like a search warrant, except it's applied against foreign nationals who are in this country. And we used to do that all the time. Before I worked for the Department of Transportation, I was in the Department of Justice and, for example, did those. And we routinely used those to follow people, for example, from the old Soviet Union, et cetera. But on that particular issue, that's exactly right. They simply did not do it, and there was really no reason that they couldn't do it. You don't need the same kinds of standards to get those warrants documents that you do for example, for doing a wiretap in this country, and it just simply wasn't done. And there are lots of draconian things that people are considering, which I don't necessarily agree with at all. But the problem is, and I think you said this in your very first line, we don't have in this country a good way to identify that people are who they say they are. In this country, we seem to be just absolutely opposed to identifying who is an American and who is not, identifying people by fingerprints or biometrics. And so if you change your name, and if someone from a foreign country changes his or her identity, we have no power to discern that with our screening system right now, which is why this trusted traveler thing doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense either. You can get a pretty good credit record, you know, without ever being who you say you are, or you can steal someone's identity. Just talk to someone who somebody has tried to swipe their credit identity, and you will find that out. So I certainly agree with you about the need for some kind of a biometric so you can figure out who everyone really is. But that also that, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of bad things taking place in this country in the name of security that really won't bring us lasting security. I agree.
On the point of the biometrics, it seems to me that if trusted travelers, if people who are first class and fly all the time as business people, which is a lot of the trade in the airlines, if they were to agree to that, that would expedite things. And then, as I say, the people that don't fly very often would have to go through Metricorni. And if you opt out of it, then you would be, you know, standing in a longer line. But the point about Mousawi and, you know, Colleen Raleigh was the whistleblower of the year on the cover of Time magazine, and now she's, I understand, she's pretty much got a threat of, she's pretty much gagged by the FBI.
She is gagged, and she has been demoted. Yes. She was busted down a rank or two, or somehow does not have the supervisory position that she used to have. And yes, some of her, she's not able to speak out freely, although she does speak out. She does write some articles. For example, she's got an article out this week. But there are things that she cannot talk about. In particular, she cannot talk about any of these matters related to the Mousawi case and related to the actual prosecution of Mousawi and things directly on point on 9/11, which is very unfortunate. But the same thing has happened, for example, to Siebel Edmonds, the translator at the FBI. Even where she hails from has now been declared to be a secret.
Was Colleen Raleigh featured in any of the 911 commission? I don't remember that. I know Sybil Edwards at least got to testify, but this seems to be a huge cover-up in plain sight to my mind. And like I say, I just think it's outrageous that we're not examining that more, and then we're being told that we have to willingly accept profiling of mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, they're that's such a large category, it doesn't even help much. If you can actually get a hard piece of evidence like flight training or something like that, that's much more important and relevant to our safety anyway. Thank you.
All right. Let's go on to, we have a caller in Belgium on our line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello. The caller there on line 4. Well, perhaps he changed his mind. Other people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit ago about what we're doing in terms of trying to screen people as they get on the plane so that they can't take weapons on. We've been talking about this issue of explosives, the fact that we check the check bags, but that we're not checking people to make sure they're not carrying them on their person, and some carry-ons are screened, but not all. I know also people who are concerned with security say that there is another big gap here, and that is cargo that is shipped on the plane, you know, just loaded into to the cargo hold,
right.
And that we're not, is it, am I correct that we're not checking any cargo now for explosives?
By and large, we are not. The cargo rules are to know your shipper or know your shipment. So people who routinely ship, for example, if you're a computer manufacturer and every Tuesday you ship, 300 custom-made computers, the rules say that, you know, they have done business and this is a known shipper, and the shipper has met the shipper has been checked out and routinely shipped. So business in the country can go forward, but you're supposed to otherwise know your, inspect each shipment. The problem is, like everything, requiring people to actually open up all the boxes when they take them, when they take them in for shipment is something that just doesn't happen, and we don't have the kinds of equipment that make that reasonable. Now, for aircraft with passengers, they are supposed to go through the same CTX screening machine. They are supposed to do that unless it is palletized, and that is not supposed to be going on to passenger aircraft. So they're supposed to receive the sort of the rudimentary CTX screening. If it's going on with people, we still have the mail. The mail goes on the planes again, and we still have some of that. The bigger worry that a lot of people have expressed are on cargo planes. Now, the cargo pilots have been allowed to go through the same training as passenger pilots. In other words, they become deputy air marshals, and they are licensed to carry weapons. They have received federal TSA training, so they have tried to give those pilots at least some measure of protection. But obviously, it doesn't take a terrorist to think of the fact that if you have a huge cargo plane, you can get cargo on that plane, and then you can take the plane over. Obviously, that's a real issue. And then, of course, the other thing that no one quite knows what to do with, and Congress barely mentions this, but it's statistically it's a very large risk, and that's the surface-to-air shoulder-fired missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very huge problem. We've seen strikes on that, attempted strikes in Africa, on Israeli planes and in other parts in the Middle East. And statistically, I think that there were actually more attempts to take out planes with surface-to-air shoulder-fired missiles than there were with bombs. So that's also a big issue, which I think it's really beyond Congress's their screens right now.
Yeah. Well, now we have several callers. I think we're going to try and get that caller from Belgium on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to point out, I'm sure this probably doesn't fall right in your bailiwick, ma'am, but it seems that the answer to our problem is being screamed right in our face every day. And the policies that that our government has in various places around the world foments the feelings for people to do this to us. If we changed our foreign policy and looked at different cultures in different ways and more sympathetic, we might very well solve our own problems before they even get started.
Well, that's kind of a different topic, but I suppose you can't exactly argue with what the caller has to say. You want to comment on that, Ms. Gamble?
No, like I say, I'm kind of a nuts and bolts kind of person and worked in aviation safety and security rather than those bigger issues over at the State Department. But, certainly speaking for myself, I mean, I have a difficult time understanding some of the cultural issues and you know, I'm sure we could all make a much greater effort to do that. I will say in Washington, D.C., having served in, you know, three different departments at an appointee level, quite frankly, a lot of our policy is based on what's on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times every day, and it's a very reactive government. So right now we're, you know, obviously reacting to these, you know, to a lot of issues in a lot of other countries, and I think everybody in Washington is in a learning curve, but frankly they're reacting to the news in the papers and around the world, so I think various messages are getting through.
All right. Well, again, I thank the caller for the comment. Let's go to Champagne next, and that would be line one. Hello.
Hi. Just a quick comment on that last caller. I think that what that caller is engaging in is blaming the victim. The fact is that these people who conduct these kinds of terrorist actions are violent people, and this is the same as saying that the woman who wears a skirt with that comes above the knee is responsible for her rape. Whatever we did is irrelevant. The fact is that they chose violent means to achieve their ends. And there were lots of other options out there. There were lots of other choices. They chose violence. So to blame America for everything in the world, especially terrorist actions, is just ridiculous, and it's blaming the victim, and it's the wrong-headed thinking. So set that aside. A couple quick questions for you. There are standards for initiating any kind of new safety or security initiative or action that you had said, and that they've got to pass that economic test. Is the risk-benefit analysis working out? Is there any kind of standard for evaluating the effectiveness of those actions or initiatives? In other words, once we do something, is there any kind of congressional standard that says we should evaluate the effectiveness in hardcore, tangible, measurable terms?
Excellent, excellent point. Yes and no. Excellent point. What happens is exactly that. We get these programs in place. For example, CAPS-1 is the best example. We put the program in place and we say, well, we've addressed this issue. And then we sort of put it in a box, we put it on the shelf, and we let it run, and we assume it's addressed it. And then there's no systematic review every year. For example, when we come up for refunding every year, you have to get your budget every year. You should be able to justify that program each and every year. And instead, they take on the life of their own. And in the case of CAPS, what happened is the way they were doing it got skewed completely from the way it was supposed to work. They were supposed to be profiling people, and they ended up only looking for bombs and suitcases, and that is the way the program went far afield, and it just got reappropriated year after year. What's supposed to happen is the General Accounting Office and each agency's department, Office of Inspector General, is supposed to review those programs annually. To the extent that they have the resources to do it, and that's the issue. They get around to programs, you know, maybe once every 5 years.
So the GAO is responsible for doing these kind of audits on government programs. Who's auditing the GAO?
They do have a quality control division where they are to look at themselves, but there's an oversight agency, the President's Council on Integrity and Efficiency, looks at the sort of the quality of these reviews, and then they have a peer review where the inspectors general, and to a certain extent the GAO, but they look at each other, so there is some kind of a peer review. The GAO, by and large, responds to requests by Congress. Congress will task them to do certain things, and they will go out and look and do, because they're an arm of Congress, and they will go out and look at what Congress has asked them to look at. By and large, they do good reviews, but they're a small office. They can only do so much every year.
I've often found it unfortunate to call a government or business organization an oversight committee, because there is a somewhat double meaning there. But the other question I had then is very much related. You had mentioned that airport workers are simply doing the same things in the same old ways, and that's why we haven't really seen a lot of changes in performance. In the last 2-3 years, you've heard all kinds of stories about the giant quantities of weapons that have been brought aboard, set aside, you know, things that could be weapons like knitting needles, but are not commonly thought of as weapons. But you hear all these examples, and you never hear any follow-up. You always hear promises that we're going to retrain our people at X airport. We're going to retrain our people at this particular terminal. But you never hear any results of that.
Yeah.
These are low-paid, low-respected employees. We've got, as you had pointed out, I thought it was a tremendous issue that, for example, the baggage screeners are rotated every 30 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we see any changes in actual policy and practice in this country, and why isn't the government making that happen, since they're in charge of these kind of procedures? It just seems like the little contractors who were hiring unskilled, untrained, unprofessional individuals, they're not being forced to do the right thing for safety. And I know from my own experience, I can name three or four airports that I've been through in the last 3 years that it's very clear that they're making decisions based on personal stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the person who complains the most. It's the person who has the most, let's call it ethnic or religious garb on. It's not the person who may be dangerous. You know, they just make arbitrary decisions based on their own personal bias. And, you know, nobody's doing anything about this. Why is the government not forcing this to happen? And I'll go ahead and get off and let you answer. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, I should premise this by saying this is my opinion, but the fact of the matter is, and I think it's pretty clear from what's been going on in Washington, the government does not intend long term to be in this business. The government made a big hoopla, if you recall, when the TSA was formed, that these screeners would be government employees but not real government employees, meaning that they would not incur sort of the long-term rights and benefits of government employees, so they could be fired at will. And a lot of people said, well, that was so you can really enforce the rules against them and get a real crackerjack organization. I think it's clear now that we are discussing reprivatizing. And remember, that was in the legislation, even after 9/11. That this can be reprivatized and given back to the security companies that failed so miserably on 9/11, and that is what we see happening. Starting as early as next year, private airports will be able to bid with private companies to do this, and to do this undoubtedly cheaper, and it will be able to go back into private industry. For example, some of the security companies who failed on 9/11 actually sued the government, saying that the government took away their business and owed them pay for taking away their private enterprise. And so I think by next year we'll see the government going back to giving these to these cheapest bidders to provide the security, and that's why we really don't see a lot of effort placed on the long-term development of these employees, and that's why one of the things I wanted to see was that airport security be treated as an arm of an existing organization like the Coast Guard, like Customs, some kind of an organization which already knew law enforcement, already did a good job. Coast Guard does a mighty good job. Customs does a pretty good job, too. And where people would have a career progression. You wouldn't be a screener your whole life. And we don't see that at all. I think we're going back to the old system, and that's why you don't see a real emphasis on training and a real emphasis on a development of these employees. That being said, I like the fact that we did this after 9/11 because we needed to get control of who was working in our airport. The fact that Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., or in Virginia outside of Washington, had perhaps as high as 80% of the screeners were illegal aliens meant that persons illegally in this country were all that we had to enforce our security. So I appreciate the fact that we did at least for a couple years, 3 years here, the anniversary's this week, coming up, at least for a couple years, we had U.S. citizens looking at U.S. flight operations. We won't have that too much longer, I don't think.
Just though, occasionally the stories continue to come up that make you wonder about who it is that's doing this work. And this summer, for example, it's fairly routine that screeners who work for the Transportation Security Administration will open and inspect some percentage of checked bags looking for possible explosives. Well, this summer at three major airports, 20 baggage screeners were charged with stealing things from checked bags. And if we can't trust them not to steal stuff out of our baggage, can we trust them to be doing what they're supposed to be doing and making sure that there are no explosives that go on the plane?
No. There are bad government employees in every part of government, and that further explains that there are going to be problems in the system. There are going to be places where things fail. We had the same thing happen, of course, before it was the TSA as well. We had the theft rings, we had drug rings, planting drugs in airplanes and things like that. So we have had problems under both systems, but I simply cannot tolerate a large branch of our law enforcement, which is what we should think of airport personnel as, but we should not have United States law enforcement performed by foreign nationals. To me, that was absurd, and I believe we'll probably end up back in that same situation again. But aside from the fact that a few people were bad, I mean, we have bad Secret Service agents and bad FBI agents and bad government servants occasionally too. And for me, that was not a reason to say, well, we'll go back to the old system. I liked the fact that they were government employees, and the reason they had to be government employees is that is the only employer who may discriminate against its employees on the basis of citizenship. And I think that's important. We need U.S. citizens protecting U.S. airports.
Let's go to the phones again here. We have a caller in Kankakee, line number two. Hello.
Good morning, David Inch and Guest Mary Scavel.
Yes.
It was mentioned earlier that one of the results of the increasing annoyances of airport security is that there is a movement toward personal jet transportation among the wealthy. Might this suggest that there could also be a corresponding movement of terrorists toward personal jet transportation? Thank you.
Well, Ms. Gamma?
Absolutely. I think that's what people, for example, people will remember about a year and a half ago, a 707 went missing in Africa. A 707 was unaccounted for. No one knew where it went. And I think there's a concern in this country about private aircraft and how you do police that. And, of course, That issue died down. We had a lot of issues about that right after 9/11. What do you do about the Cessnas? Who's policing the small planes of America parked at, on 14,000 airstrips all over the country? And there wasn't much that was said about that. There wasn't much that we could say or do. So we made an effort to try to keep track of the pilots, who's on our pilot records, who's in our pilot logs. That doesn't do anything to help us, determine who was a pilot trained overseas and then gets into this country through illegal means. And remember, one of the things that came out in the prosecution of the World Trade Center bombers before 9/11, the previous bombing on the World Trade Center, is that Osama bin Laden had sent a pilot into this country to purchase the King Air in Texas. And this was back in the early 90s, and fly that King Air airplane over to the Middle East. And so once you have the planes and the abilities to do that overseas, it's very, very difficult to find out who's doing what. And so we have international plane registries, and we have, or at least we're working to have, international pilot registries. But the problem that we've had is several countries, including Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia, would not cooperate with us. And so that's a big issue, and that's right. If terrorists can afford multi-million dollar operations, it's going to be important to not only, track the terrorists, but track the flow of money.
All right. We're trying to get one or two more calls. Next is Herrick, line number three. Hello.
Hi. As a air traveler myself, and I get searched probably 100 times a year, I find the searches to be really inconsistent. So I think a lot of the security has actually got to be in the aircraft itself. So there's two things about the aircraft that I kind of wonder about. The first thing is, why do we allow a foreign national to pilot an aircraft over our airspace in the first place? And secondly, why do we allow commercial airliners to be designed where there's access from the cabin? It would seem to make it a lot safer to have access from the outside only, and once they're in the air, that would kind of solve, the problem of hijackings altogether. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
All right. Well, on the foreign nationals, you're absolutely right, and you make a great point. This issue came up several times before 9/11 in a lot of interesting ways. One airline had tried to require, for example, their pilots to be U.S. citizens. A foreign national with a green card sued the airline. The decision of the courts were that you had to allow foreign nationals with a green card to be treated exactly the same way as U.S. citizens. So even in U.S. aviation, foreign nationals are allowed to participate in the system and fly in the system. But foreign planes coming into this country are allowed to fly over our airspace by virtue of international treaties in connection with the International Civil Aviation Organization, which is a part of the United Nations. And the United States has been a signatory to most of those treaties. There are a few that we didn't sign. But by doing so, we allow overflight over our country It's called the Five Freedoms of Flight, and we sign on to almost all of them. Of course, interior flights have to be flown by U.S. carriers here, but that's broken down so significantly that at this point, we're talking about, in aviation circles, they're talking about even going further, that allowing even foreign operators, airplane operators, to operate within this country with point-to-point service in this country. So that's a huge issue. We had difficulty, even after 9/11, getting some countries, such as Saudi Arabia, to tell us even anything about their pilots who are bringing planes into this country. And this is true even after the tragic crash of Egypt Air, which is a suicide crash that occurred before 9/11, 2 years before 9/11. So huge issue on that. On the cabin access issue, obviously El Al has the system where you have the double door system, which is makes it much, much more difficult, and it's a hardened double door system. It's supposed to be able to resist explosives, so you simply cannot get to the cockpit. Other people are asking more basic questions. For example, why do we not have, with this age of computers, and there are many modern, wonderful flight systems that have great safety overrides, why do we not require our planes at this point to be built towards a system which simply will not allow the aircraft to be flown into objects? And that system's already programmed in the plane. We have the entire topographical map of the world programmable into a very small flight computer. Literally on the computer screens of the day, the World Trade Centers actually should have popped up on the screens in the planes. And had we had those systems on board, it would not have been possible to cause that collision. So there are lots of systems out there that could make attacks like this in the future less likely, and some things even more basic, like hardened luggage containers. So the old bomb in the suitcase wouldn't work either. But those technologies are expensive, and that's always going to be the big debate in Washington. What's worth our investment as a nation? And then we have some people that just simply refuse to address it. They just say, it's the cost of doing business. And it's that kind of attitude that often prevails in Washington. So
we're
going to come down to dollars.
We're going to have to leave it there. My apologies for people we can't take, but we've simply used our time. Our guest this morning, Mary Schiavo, she's former Inspector General of the U.S. Department of Transportation, is now an attorney, has been for a long time following issues of aviation safety and security. Ms. Schiavo, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.